Hi, this is Dave Pryor, and welcome to Leading Agile Sound Notes. This is iteration 9, and today, John Mason, who is one of our coaches, has taken some time away from helping the world find a better way to work, and he's going to help us talk a little bit about some of the different things that are related to his approach to coaching and the work that he does for Leading Agile. So, John, thank you for taking time out of your Friday.
I'm glad to be here.
Could you give the folks who are listening just kind of a brief overview of the work that you do in coaching? Like, if there's specific areas that you focus on, or you know, where what kind of stuff you're doing right now?
I've been focused so far on getting folks to Basecamp 1 in the Leading Agile world. That's to be getting them to a point where their development efforts are predictable when they start a sprint. You know, they commit to a certain number of story points. And then at the end of the sprint, we want to see that they've actually accomplished and delivered that many story points. And also at the same time, we want to make sure they're not budging any in the stories they committed to at the beginning of the sprint. We want to make sure that they've actually delivered those stories at the end as well. So we use our metrics to track how well they're doing in that regard. And my job is to help make them make the right decisions, follow the metrics, understand what we're how they're being measured, and then to structure their sprints in a way that they can be successful doing that.
Okay, so for people who aren't familiar with the base camps, one of the things that's I'd say it's fairly unique to our approach is that rather than just saying we're going to come in and help you become agile, and it's just like this imaginary path to agility, we realize that different people are going through different stages and approaching it in different ways, and so. There are five different base camps that we've identified. Stages of development is an easy way to think of it. And the first one is base camp one. And the main things that you're trying to get you there, it's delivering every sprint, right? Making the meeting commitments and having a consistent velocity.
Right. Yeah, we do the metrics. They give us an insight as to the competencies the team need to be able to exhibit. And so each of the base camps, as you mentioned, has different competencies that we're targeting and developing. So in base camp one, it's making meet, you know, basic planning, basic commitment practice. And then as we move around to base camp two, it's looking at dependencies and becoming more predictable. And base camp three has another set of competencies where we're developing better long-term planning and predictability continues to be part of the theme. So as we go through each base camp, we don't want to lose any of the previous base camp competencies. We're trying to add on more and make the teams more capable and more able to exhibit agile behaviors and disciplines.
Okay, so when we talk about metrics, I mean, you mentioned that obviously we want to have a backlog, a prioritized backlog, right?
Sure. It's one of the things we measure.
Now, is there a specific thing that you look at in trying to measure the backlog, or is it just saying, okay, we need to have a backlog full of stuff and it has to be prioritized?
Well, we look at the number of story points that are represented by the stories in the backlog, and we look at the stories that are in a ready state. So we have a definition of ready, which is agreed upon between the developers and the folks that are doing the analysis. And we make sure that they... That body of ready stories is about 2 to 3 sprints, depending, of course, upon where the teams are in their transition. Teams that are farther along, we don't demand or expect quite as extensive a backlog. But for teams that are just getting started, we want to have them not only practice, but we want to make sure that they've got sufficient stories that if they have issues inside the sprint and less mature teams and to have that happen, that they've got a story that's available that they can bring into the sprint so they don't get blocked or backed up or sit around idle.
So even if they can't finish what they said they were going to do in the beginning, there's still enough on the table for them to take something else.
Exactly. We want to make sure that they have enough and that there's enough variability in the size of those stories that they can slot something in just about any place in the sprint so they don't have to worry about, you know, 3 days away from the end and oh my goodness, what
sure.
They're going to do.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you a very important question. It's important to me personally because I might play this for my classes when I'm doing the CSM classes. Okay. Well, you just mentioned sprint, having a definition of sprint ready. So do you have specific guidance or counsel that you provide to people or teams when they're trying to come up with, like, they've never done that before. Most of my classes, nobody's ever heard of a definition of sprint ready until they're in the class. So how do you, what advice do you give to a team that's just getting started with that?
Sprint ready would be that there are no known dependencies, external dependencies in the story. So they've already been addressed before the sprint starts. That the story is of a known size that will fit inside of a sprint and reliably sized. You've used what we talk about as anchor stories as a means to size it. So you have a reference point with a historical basis so that you have a high level of confidence about the size. The story has to have a priority so the team knows exactly where it needs to fit the backlog. We want to have acceptance criteria, well-defined acceptance criteria, the given conditions, when, you know, then a results statement so that you can actually measure when you're done or when you've accomplished or completed the story. Let's see. I think that's most of the point. Yeah, that's the starting point. I think there's also things like if you've got a UI design, you make sure that the design works there. And if you have architectural considerations, they have been resolved and there's some solution that's available that will not result in a side trip in order to get some additional information.
All right.
The whole point of the definition of ready that you're working for is that when this story comes into the sprint, it has a very, very high level of confidence. You know, 98% level of confidence.
They're going to be able to get it done.
Yeah, 95% to 98% level of confidence that you'll be completing that inside the sprint.
Okay. All right, so they have to have this backlog with about 3 sprints worth of work. It has to be prioritized by the product owner or the product owner team. And then when they start working, are there specific things that you want to be trying to counsel them on during the course of creating this work in the middle of the sprint when they're working towards Basecamp 1?
Well, they have to make sure that the people who've had a chance to look at it, we have to make sure that everybody on the team's had a chance to look at it before it actually goes into the sprint. So there's no surprises coming in. And so during the backlog grooming sessions, we'll make sure that it's not just the business analysts and the product owner side of the world that are putting the stories together. It makes sure that the development, the code folks and the QA folks, all the members of the team have had a chance to look at it and review it. I like to suggest that at least twice it's gone through a full review, that everybody's had a chance to look at it, just so that you have a level of confidence in that. But the normal process of grooming stories is you're going to see it 2, 3, maybe 4 times, just as you mature it from the first initial proposal to actually fully sprint ready.
Right. So they've been through this thing a bunch of times, but once they've made the commitment and they start working, Are there specific things that you would be watching with a team that's at this state of just trying to get to Basecamp 1, specific things that you would be, you know, kind of worried about or helping them really kind of lock in on?
Oh, absolutely. During the stand-up meetings is the critical exercise here and the critical discipline. You want to make sure that the team is focused on delivery versus status. Oftentimes people get into the habit of, well, I did this yesterday and I did this yesterday and did this yesterday, rather than I made this much progress. It represents half of the time that I committed to take to get this story done. And I've still got half the time left, so I'm on track. And so during the course of the sprint, and you want to keep them focused on progress rather than status or activity. That's a critical change of mindset for a lot of developers.
So can you say that again? I just want to make sure that it's clear for everybody. The difference between progress and status.
Status is a list of the activities that you performed yesterday and maybe some activities that you performed today that may have nothing to do or don't advance the completion of the story. Progress is how far along I am in getting this story done relative to what I committed to. So how many hours I spent is certainly a critical measure, but what I really want to know is how likely are you to get this story done in the time frame that you promised?
So how do they know that? How do they have, because there's always the guy who's like, oh yeah, it's trivial, I'll totally have this done in time, and then you're like, geeks can't.
Oh, sure.
So we're asking
them, how far along are you and how much do you have left?
Okay.
And so with the how far along are you and how much you have left, you get an understanding of how they're working against the projection or the commitment.
Yeah.
So if it's a 2-day effort and at the end of day one, you know, you've still got 2 days left, then obviously you're not making the level of progress that you originally had expected.
But you still want the honesty, though, right? You wouldn't want them. Like, I used to work with a guy who would say, yeah, I'm almost done, and then he would go back to the hotel and work all night
long. Sure. Yeah, and that's, I think, I call it the culture of deceit that kind of is a pervasive thing in software development. And it's not malicious deceit. I mean, it's accidental lies. You know, it's when you promise that you're going to go to the grocery store and you're going to get milk and you come back with eggs and cheese. You didn't intend to not come back with milk. You just didn't make a list and you forgot it. Well, the same thing happens inside of software. You intend to get it done, but you know, something unexpected come up, or it turned out to be twice as big as you thought it was going to be, or any of the other things. And culturally, you know, inside of software development, there's all these little hedges that we have, you know.
Right.
I think it'll be 2 days, but you know, something might come up and get in the way, and so that whole level of promise that we make is culturally kind of shifted. I mean, and everybody in the equation does it. You know, managers, because they don't know for sure how long their developer is going to really take, they pad the schedules, and customers ask for more because they hope that they'll get what they really need. So,
yeah.
So what we're trying to do is definitely begin to bring people around to make your promises, keep your promises. And that's the language that I use, is that when we're planning a sprint, you're making a promise. And, you know, I'm using a serious tone of voice and focusing people on the gravity of it. You know, this is not just a wink-wink situation. You're making a promise. You're expected to keep the promise. And once that's in place, though, you have a lot of leverage and you have a real significant power that you now have in the organization.
Okay.
Because management and the folks who make the decisions on how to utilize the corporate resources, they have a high regard for folks who make promises and actually can keep their promise.
Sure. So where do you come down on the whole commitment forecast debate?
Say that again?
The debate over whether to use the word commitment or the word forecast. Do you have strong feelings?
You need to make commitments.
Thank you.
I really hate the metaphor. I really hate the metaphor, you know, the pig chicken metaphor. Because
what?
The pig, you know, there's the whole pig chicken metaphor about breakfast.
Right. I thought you said pink chicken. You know, I was very confused.
No, they have pink chicken.
Yeah, I got it. Chicken, yes. Totally understand. Right.
Yeah. Right. It bothers me just, you know, because of the imagery there, but the level that you're after is, yes, you need to be committed. And the thing is that it's very difficult, I think, for software developers to take that committed stand because they get burned by it so often.
Yeah.
I'm going to commit to get.
Yeah, they're afraid to make a commitment because they don't want to be hung by it. And we're all bad at figuring out what we're going to do.
Exactly. And so one of the things that we do is by bringing that integrity, that commitment language strongly into the environment, is we build the energy, the need to come up with ways in which the software folks, the development team, can actually confidently make those commitments. So that's when I talk about anchor story. We build a set of stories, a set of gauges, if you will, that people can compare stories to. So I look at a story and I say, out of my set of anchors, I say, this is a medium-sized story. And I take a new story and I compare it to that one and say, okay, well, it's got characteristics that are similar to that, but it doesn't have quite this one thing. So I look at the one that's a little smaller and I match up the characteristics to the gauge, and they match fairly well. I can say with a fairly high level of confidence that this story is, you know, in the same class as this other story, so I will assign it the same number of story points.
Sure.
And so we'll do an additional review. We'll, you know, go through poker or whatever we want to go through to allow the rest of the team to provide their insights. And this is where I think the confidence begins to go up in the quality of the estimate and the commitment, in that when you get the insights from everyone who's going to make a contribution to getting this complete, getting this story complete, you get a better understanding and a broader knowledge and better insight as to how complicated and how difficult the story is going to be. You know, you have that conversation where somebody says, oh, this really should be a 7, and somebody says it really should be a 1. Obviously, there's a complete difference in understanding of what that story, the effort that story is going to require to be completed.
Sure.
And you want to make sure that the conversation occurs between those two folks, so that the understanding of simple versus understanding of complex can be aired out, and that everybody hears that conversation, because they're going to hear something and they're going to learn something from the insights that each of these people have. And so you work your way to a level of confidence in the estimate, and when you break Brent, you can say, I will commit to doing this, because your confidence in the story is higher. But you make sure you have that level of confidence, because your commitment, not just a guess or a we'll try.
Right. Okay. So
one of the other things that I do in... Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
One of the other things... Yeah, okay. So one of the other things that I do inside the sprint is I... speak to the language that people use. We want to encourage people not to say I hope or I'll try. You know, it reminds me of that Star Wars thing. You know, there is no try, there's only do.
Excuse me. Do or do not. There is no try.
Do or do. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm a little bit over the top on the Star Wars side. So.
Oh, that's fine. You can feel free to just like correct me, you know, in a clean copy. So go ahead.
That was it.
So, but yeah, it's the whole thing of you want to make the language intentional. You want to make the language all about commitment. And so you don't want to say, I'll try, or I hope, or maybe, or any of that other stuff. It's either yes or no. Right. And I know that in a software world, in a world where folks are technical, we run away screaming from that kind of language. But unless you get it, the more you get into that mindset, the more reliable you're going to be as a developer, the better your sprints are going to be, the more predictable you're going to be. And once again, when you've got the predictability, when you can make a promise and keep a promise, then that speaks a whole lot inside of an organization. And it allows the organization then to focus its attention where it needs to be focused, and can reliably make those commitments in your organization.
So I want to check one thing with you, because one of the things that I've kind of come around to the opinion of, in terms, I mean, I agree about the making and the meeting commitments, but something like Scrum, you know, people always say it's based on the three legs or the three pillars. I feel like they're all held together with trust, and that that trust begins and is held together specifically by all the commitments that are made. So it's not just the team, it's the product owner saying, this is the most important stuff, and we're going to let that be the most important stuff for the next 2 weeks without trying to change it on you. Because there is a silent commitment there as well.
Yeah, and that's what I was talking about earlier, where everybody kind of hedges their bets. It is necessary for the product owner and the larger organization, you know, the people that are who will receive the result of the development team's effort, for them to follow up on their promise as well. I kind of start with the development team as the ones who have to show their cards first, simply because they have, I think, the most control over things. And once they begin to demonstrate, they probably have the most at risk. Or actually, I may not be able to characterize it exactly.
It's funny. So when you said they have the most control, I was thinking, well, theoretically they do, but are they willing and able to wield that control?
That's the thing is that it's one of those things where inside of a world where people have been sort of winking at each other and you know, hedging their bets and not being completely forthright, and not by malice. It's not a malicious, but it's you know, you got to protect your interests kind of thing.
Right.
Or you're going to be working, you know, 80 hours a week and killing yourself. And in that environment where there is not a lot of trust, you have to be able to start somewhere. And I think when the developers say, and I'll go back to our metrics. I'll go back to the leading agile metrics. One of the metrics that we use is how many story points you committed to this go round and how many you deliver. And so it's obvious that if you commit to 100 and you deliver 50, that you're not meeting your commitments. But there's right. another metric that we look at, which is variability in how many you commit or how many you deliver. The other metric we look at is how many you deliver.
Say that again. So, variability in how many of the items you deliver. Okay.
It's this sprint you delivered 50 story points. Last sprint you delivered 45 story points. Next sprint you may deliver 55. What we see there is that you've kind of gotten to your natural velocity.
Right.
So the variability from sprint to sprint on how many points you deliver is very small. It means your process has gotten kind of stable. You're managing your dependencies well, or you have a good backlog so you can pull things in and out and make sure that you manage the development effort. But what you're seeing, though, is that there's a stable velocity.
Right.
Well, so now what you do, or what we do, is somebody talks to the management structure, to the organization, and says, look, this is this team's natural velocity. You're asking them to do twice as much as they can. You're asking them to put, you know, 10 pounds of fertilizer into a 5-pound bag. You can't do that.
That was a very polite way of using that fertilizer.
So
thank you for keeping it clean.
Well, yeah, you know, it's got to be at least a
PG-ish version.
PG or PG, PG. But the whole idea is that we can demonstrate to those folks who are asking what the real capacity is.
Yeah.
And our conversation with them is, this is their capacity. If you really want 100 points, then we have to look at the process. But we can't look at the process until you allow them the flexibility to do that. And when you expect 100, when they can deliver 50, then you're sucking any additional capacity out of the system, and you're very likely overdriving it to the point where you're actually getting less than what you really could get. You're going to get burnout. Yeah. People are going to respond to being overdriven. So once we get there, go ahead.
We say Basecamp 1 is about predictability, but it's not just the team being predictable. It's the organization's trust and acceptance of their predictability as well, right?
Yeah, that goes hand in hand, actually. Yeah, and now that you bring it up, because one of the things that I do counsel and coach the teams is that as you begin to demonstrate and the predictability and the consistency, then the organization, unless they're completely irrational, has to acknowledge that and begin to make the changes necessary. You know, the organization needs to make the changes necessary to operate in this newfound level of commitment and begin to build that trust. So it's somebody's got to go out there.
So hold on. Because what you just said, I'm having a little bit of trouble with. So an organization is brought a bunch of facts. This is how fast they go. We've proven this over and over again. And you expect them to be rational with that information?
Organization?
It's a joke, yeah. I when you were saying it, I was thinking like, well, yeah, that would be great. And, you know.
You would think so, but there are some.
Like rational organization. Yeah. Come on.
Right. There are some organizations that aren't, but
they don't want to be. They want to go back to that world of like, no, I'm just going to bang my fist and cry until I get what I want. And grow people under my
nose. Sure. Yeah, and that's an interesting question. How do you deal with, and I think eventually and ultimately what happens is that we go into situations typically when there's more than one team.
Right.
And so possibly three out of the four will get it, or one will get it. Okay. And one will understand what's going on. One will get their velocity down, you know, by hook or crook or whatever they do. They're just defiant and say, no, I'm not going to do any more than what I can do. And in the process of becoming more predictable and making their meeting their commitments, they begin to perform better. And they demonstrate to the organization that if you really comply or really adhere to the promises that you made when you said we're going to be agile and really adopt the practices that you said you were going to adopt when you said we're going to be agile, you'll actually see the results. And then what happens is the other elements of the organization begin to conform to expectations of the agile world. And so I think it's one of those things where a little bit of success, you get that feedback loop and people begin to say, oh, okay, yeah, I get it, or I start to get it. And as they begin to continue to adopt and move forward, you know, we as coaches remind them and demonstrate and display as much as possible their appropriate behaviors. We point out the behaviors on somebody else's gut. Sure. Going and how they're being successful. So it's all just part of the coaching.
Do you think that the predictability, it almost seems like for the team or for the organization, I mean, you get predictability and everyone's like, well, this is cool. I want more. I mean, it almost seems like it sets, I think it's cool that the base camps are there. I think that the way that they're structured, it creates like a natural tension point that would hopefully push the or help the organization find its way to be like, how do we get more? And then that base camp two would be, you know, reducing batch size would be, well, this is the next step.
That's part of that feedback loop is that we've come to understand that predictability is the first discipline and the first characteristics that need to be brought into the team and to demonstrate. Once those capabilities are demonstrated, then we can build on that so we can start reducing the batch size. But we have that whole, well, this base camp brought these results and you can see those results. So now you can have a little bit more confidence in it in the next step. And so we bring that into it. But it's also, before you can reduce batch size and you can start doing some of these other disciplines, you have to know what the team's capacity is, because you have to know how to allocate that capacity to begin to address some of these other issues.
Sure. And that makes total sense.
And it's one of those things where if I'm trying to reduce batch size and I need to groom my backlog more, I have to have a certain amount of time to groom my backlog. So if I've got a predictable velocity and I know how many story points that I can rely on in a sprint for the poorly groomed world, then let's take the hours that are equivalent to, you know, five or six story points and commit them to grooming that's designed to reduce the batch size, make the story smaller.
Yeah.
And then, and so, so now the now the organization can make that decision, though. They have a basis in which they can make the decision and determine how much time they want to commit to that and how much of their resources they want to make available to begin to improve the process, because that's one of the other messages that they get is this is their natural velocity. If you don't improve the process, this is going to be their natural velocity. And if you really want to get improved
productivity,
you've got to
do something if you want it to get better. Yeah.
Yeah, if you want it to get better, you've got to give them some time in order to be able to make improvements that will get them better.
Yeah, or not just give them time, but you've got to let other things in this organization change as well if you want them to be able
to get better. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and that's one of those things where some of the techniques that we suggest, I mean, we, you know, we've got some techniques about how to find the stories that are going to be able to get enough work done to satisfy the requirements, or find out what is the smallest number of stories that will actually satisfy the market. I mean, there is, you know, kind of the same notion, but you can't really readily apply those techniques if you've got three stories that are, you know, 70 story points big each. You have to be able to break them down. And so, yeah, but the whole idea is that once you get the ball rolling and you start making your resource allocation, you can start getting productivity. And people kind of like to think of productivity as, oh, I'm going to get more code per hour out of people. And in fact, I think what really the productivity is the idea of more value per hour out of people.
Right.
And so it's not that you're going to get more lines of code necessarily, but the lines of code you're going to get are the most valuable lines of code. You know, there's an exercise we do in our Agile 101 class where we have batch sizes, and we use coins to represent the batches, and the folks move them around, and eventually we break the batches down into smaller batches. And there's one set of sequences where people move coins and they pick the easiest ones, the ones that are most consistent with the requirements of the exercise. And then we count up how much money that represents. And then we say, okay, but now focus on the high value coins. And so of course they're getting all the, you know, Susan B. Anthony's and all the dollars moved through first. And the last time I did the exercise, they doubled the amount of value that they were able to push through the system simply by focusing on the things of high value. So, you know, they doubled their productivity, same amount of effort, twice as much value.
Yeah, I think once we can break the world of the addiction to the idea that it's a, you know, like utilization reports, like what percent of their time is fully used? Well, all of it. Always all of it. One way or another, all their time is used.
One way or the other.
And doesn't speak to what is valuable or what we can actually ship, which is what people should be more worried about.
Right. And that goes back to that whole thing of progress over status.
Yeah.
When you spend a minute doing something, make sure it's a minute getting closer to being done with that story. And if it's not, and you can't get closer to done with the story, or you're spending time that doesn't move you closer to done with the story, well, you're blocked.
Yep.
Okay? And then, so how do you get that out of the way? And that's another concept that developers have trouble with, is the idea that if I can stay busy, I'm not blocked. And so you have to help them understand that, no, if you're not making progress towards getting the story finished, you're blocked. There's a difference between the two. Yeah.
Cool. So I want to switch gears. I've only got about 5 minutes left, but before we finish up, I'd like to switch gears and ask you a little bit about something we talked about before we started recording. So, in looking at your LinkedIn profile, I noticed you have a theater listed there. You come from a software development background, but now you're working as a coach, which is a very different type of gig. Can you talk about the theater aspect and sort of explain what you were saying to me before we started recording?
Yeah, when there's a local community theater group that I managed to get engaged with on a in their board of directors and as a support person. So when they had shows, I would go down and I would staff the concession stands and things like that and help out with tear down and those sort of things after the show's over. And so it's not on stage, but I think I realized as I interact with the actors that they're different people than who they are on stage. And I'm a kind of shy person at times until you get to know me. I've noticed that by taking on a bit of a persona at times, you know, adopting a role or a character, I can interact with in a situation where I'm a little bit more effective, I think, because it's not necessarily me, you know, out there doing it. It's the expectations of that role of that I'm projecting the coach, the leader, or whatever needs to be there.
And if you're introverted, that takes some of the sting away. I mean, my experience has been the same. When I first started teaching or speaking in public, I'd get super nervous. And then I would think about that line from the David Mamet line where he says, well, how did you figure out what to do? And Gene Hackman says, oh, I imagined somebody smarter than myself and I did what he would do. And so when I started speaking, I'm like, I would get super nervous and think, well, you know what? I'm just going to go out there and pretend that I'm the version of me. Like a couple of years from now, like if I wasn't nervous, what would I do?
Right.
And I think if you can imagine a bit or a persona or another version of yourself and just play that role, it's weird how that makes it so much easier to be different than yourself sometimes.
Yeah, of course. The weird thing is that when I've been in situations where I'm speaking to a large number of people, I mean, you know, faceless crowd.
Right.
I have no trouble with it. But it's when I'm in a situation where there's like five or six people around the table that I don't know, you know,
you
it's
actually,
like, oh my goodness,
yeah.
You know, and watch their reactions and all that other stuff. It's kind of, you know, it's an thing,
yeah.
But yeah, I come from a software development world, but there was a time when I have done coaching in the past on a regular basis. I worked for a company that was a transition company. Before the transitioning we would do was taking people from traditional programming paradigm into the object paradigm. And my role in that company, I did classroom activities as well as we had a program we called the Mentor Program, Mentor. And clients would send their development staff to our have intensive two-week sessions with them as they worked through developing a prototype of their product.
Okay.
And so they would be there for 2 weeks, gone for a week, back for 2 weeks. And so we would go through that cycle for, you know, 5 to 6 weeks of one-on-three training was the goal.
Sure.
So I was one of the leads for that activity. So the whole coaching one-on-one small group kind of activity, I'm really used to that and understand some of the dynamics and have been working on those dynamics for a long time. So it's really, really refreshing to get back into that mode of operation after being a pseudo project manager, developer, business analyst kind of person for a number of years.
Cool. All right. So if people want to, if anybody's got follow-up questions or they want to track you down, they can obviously find you on the Leading Agile site. Find you on LinkedIn. Is there any place else people should be looking for you, like Twitter, you know, anything like that?
I don't tweet a lot. I think that will start picking up probably. The thing is, my Twitter handle is Chef John.
Okay.
Which is a story of itself. I've actually been to culinary school and graduated and cook a little bit professionally.
You are a man of many skills. That's cool.
Yeah.
He says so, with extreme confidence.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's a whole lot of stuff, but
cool. Well, we'll have to talk about the cook.
Yeah.
Maybe if we do another one in the future, we can talk about parallels between cooking and agile. It might be kind of a cool thing.
Sure. Yeah, one of the big parallels is you promise you're going to cook something, you better cook it.
Yeah, you better not kill anybody with bad food, too.
You bet. Yeah, that's a big one, yeah. Yeah, that's the first class they put you through is food safety.
Cool. All right, thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate this.
You're welcome.